are listening to the Poetry Salon Cast. The Poetry Salon is on a mission to provide inspiration, education, and access to a high-quality artistic community at a price that is affordable. If you want to find out more about the Poetry Salon and join one of our many online workshops, take one of our e-courses, or come to one of our readings or book club discussions, find out more about us and how you can join at www.thepoetrysalon.com. Now, enjoy our interview with our featured guest artist.
Hello, listeners. We're doing something unique today. I'm talking with my cousin, John Pearson, and we're doing something that I want to call a creativity pep talk. I've been thinking about this for a while because teaching at the Poetry Salon, I often get questions from students that I can't fully address in the context of our class on craft and editing. And of course, the first person I thought to talk about them with is my cousin, John Pearson. I call him my cousin, but technically he's my dad's cousin, Uncle John. He's had a little more experience and he's a lot wiser than I am about creativity. John Pearson went to UC Santa Cruz, my alma mater, way back in the 70s. He got some kind of degree, like a master's in philosophy from San Francisco State, I think, and has been teaching creativity workshops since about the time I was born, as long as I've been alive. And I often say that, John, it's your fault that I'm a writer. It just seemed appropriate that you and I could like bat some ideas back and forth.
Thank you, Tricia. I guess I'll jump in. Tricia is a wonderful human being, I've got to say that, and a brilliant poet. And I'm proud to be her whatever I am, cousin, uncle, something. And proud that I had some influence on her career path, actually. I did go to UC at Santa Cruz when it first began. I think it was there the second year, from 66 to 70, which makes me a really old person. my motto is, the older I get, the younger I feel. And there is real truth to that. You know, I mean, I feel younger. What keeps me younger is my imagination. I'm going to be 5 years old forever.
You're doing a little bit of a Benjamin Button thing, just, you know, aging backwards.
Something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just wanted to say that, yeah, my uncle cousin, I learned, incidentally, in an introduction to literature course at UC Santa Cruz, that in Shakespeare's time, you just use the word cousin for all manner of relations. So, right. You know, second cousin, third cousin, my sister's brother's nephew's uncle's roommate, it was just all cousin. So if you weren't like the person's father or mother or brother, you were just cousin. So I think cousin is a nice catch-all. So in the Shakespearean sense, Uncle Cousin John works for me.
Well, and along those lines, if I may jump in with some little piece of information back in Shakespeare's time, or perhaps before that, I think the word girl stood for all children. And the word deer stood for all animals, and the word meat stood for all food. I may have that slightly wrong. It might be boy stood for all children, but basically I was struck by that, there was so wide range. I don't know why I'm even bringing this up right now.
No, I think we should change the whole purpose of this podcast is just to out trivia each other on, you know, anyone introduces a subject and then we'll just list off all the things we know until one of us calls uncle or cousin.
Yeah.
So John, you and I've both been facilitating creativity workshops at the Poetry Salon, generating new writing. So we have some students in common, and I just want to say, I say students, in all honesty, a lot of the folks who join us are my age, older than me. Some of them have more books published than I have. They've won more awards. So it's very strange to call them students. I think I prefer to just call them writers. You know, I am facilitator. They are the facilitatee. But occasionally I just say student because I've been an English teacher for a long time and that's just what I'm used to saying. So we've gotten some good questions. I think the one that seems most appropriate to start with is one of our...
If I can jump in really quickly.
Yeah, go right ahead.
What you just said, it seems appropriate. Yeah, I've been teaching the Tuesday morning at 9 a.m. class, and it's generative writing. But indeed, the people there are very, very advanced. And even if somebody were new and came into the, quote, advanced group, nobody's left behind. I try to find good in everybody's writing. And also, my theory as a teacher is that we're all teachers, and that the teachers that are the best teachers, the great teachers, are always learning things. And everybody has something to learn. Everybody has something to teach. So even though I'm, quote, the facilitator slash teacher, I get wonderful information from people, and it goes both ways. So anyway, that's it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I started facilitating when I was 20 something. And a lot of our students, all of them had more life experience than I did. And I was really uncomfortable with that for a long time until I realized, like, you know, I have a lot of experience studying literature, poetry, language. And basically what I was doing was asking questions and just giving them ideas and inspiration and some technical skills about how to make their answers to my question more interesting. And once I realized that, I got a lot more comfortable working with people who are, you know, all age ranges and different backgrounds for me, because I'm not top down trying to teach them things about what I know. I'm just asking them questions and showing them how to use language to answer them more effectively. Right. And I feel like that's been really effective. That's been really good. It's been good for me, because sometimes I go into a situation with people who I know are a lot smarter than I am, and I would feel scared trying to teach them something. It's much easier to ask them questions and get them talking and do a little bit more active listening instead. Anyway, so I'm going to ask you a question. And I do also want to just say to those who don't know us too well, you know, John, you and I have we have different lifestyles, I think. We have some different approaches to creativity. I think anyone reading a piece you wrote and anyone reading a piece I wrote, they would have no confusion about who wrote what. Your voice is very distinct. I know a John Pearson piece of creative writing, short story, poem, flash fiction, whatever you want to call it. I know it within the first few sentences. I think maybe you could say that of my work as well. But anyways, we have very different approaches to creative writing, which is why I thought it would be fun for us to talk, because we're going to have some different opinions here. So the first question I have is from one of our folks, one of our writers that we know, who was asking, how do you keep up a regular writing routine even when life gets crazy? And I think that's probably something a lot of people struggle with. So what's your answer to that?
Well, a phrase comes to my mind, and it's three words: make it fun. Mm-hmm. Just make it fun. I a little teeny bit more about myself so people get some context. I've worked in education for many, many years as a consultant and went all over the country. I work with over 1,000 schools, 1 million kids, and I know that's, and teachers, and that sounds like bragging. My point was to show how to use drawing as a reading, writing, and memory tool. And included in that is writing. So it was right brain ways, in other words, poetic ways, to teach left brain stuff. So learned a lot from that. How it leads into the question you asked was, I was doing lots and lots of programs all over the place and working very hard. I'm thinking back now to 1996, and I had a big white Chevy Astro van, and I slammed the door of the van, and the phrase, "He lived inside Edward G. Robinson's head," floated to mind. And Edward G. Robinson was this actor who played gangsters in the 30s. I'm an old guy, so I remember stuff like that. and so what I did was, I went home and I started writing this thing. It was called In the Nostrils of an Icon. It was a story about a guy who lived in an amusement park in a stucco replica of Edward G. Robinson, i.e. mm-hmm. in Edward G. Robinson's head, and he just looked at the nostril. And I wrote about everything: life, death, sex, bugs, interplanetary space travel. And every time I got stuck, I just thought, it doesn't have to make sense. This is just a guy having reveries. Now, the reason I'm starting with this is, I would work all day. I'd be doing teacher workshops and so on. And they would always think, well, what's the point? What's the main idea? What are you teaching? How did you teach it? Check for understanding, all of this. very structured stuff, which is fine. I mean, we probably need that to build roads and bridges and so on. But when I got home, I just hopped on the bicycle of my mind and went out into the endless backyard. And I just started writing about this guy, who, you know, everything. I wrote about clowns and death and rodeos. And it was just this long stream thing that went on for 835 pages. And I would write a couple hours a night. And I did just joy. So my point is, if you want to have a writing schedule, it's great to be methodical about that, but doing something that takes you and is fun is the essence of it. I do my best production when three things happen. One, I have a deadline. Two, I have a loving audience. And three, it's a little bit of a challenge. In other words, I have to press myself. So I wrote for my wife. I write things for my wife because I love my wife. I wrote 50 stories. These are flash fiction, one-page things in like 28 days because she was gone for 2 weeks. And so keeping up with the schedule is easy because I pictured my wife and then I wrote about stuff the way I wanted to write. And it was blessed. So I guess the simple answer to that is if you don't find it fun on some level, you really will not keep doing it. And granted, there are times I don't feel like writing. Mm-hmm. But I'll, if I'm lucky, I'll write anyway. I don't know if that answers the question, but
I actually want to press you on that a little bit because I've heard the Edward G. Robinson story many times. I'm a young person, but I have access to the internet. So I know about gangsters and 1930s actors because I can look them up and see clips of them on YouTube. But I'm curious on about two things you said. And the first is, I know you've told that story often about slamming your door and having that hit your brain. And I'm really curious what led up to that. I mean, had you been thinking about writing something? Had you been watching a lot of gangster movies? What is your relationship to Edward G. Robinson?
That's a great question. No, absolutely none. I have no relationship to him. I wasn't thinking about gangsters at all. What I did learn is the difference between ideas that I have and ideas that have me. I discovered this a while ago. There's a difference for me between ideas that I have and ideas that have me. The ideas that have me, I need to run with. I need to go with those things. They just come. They float in from God knows where. I once did a one-man thing all about being an insect. And that came because I was staring in a mirror and in a dormitory in Buffalo, New York. This was 20 years ago. And the guy looking back out of the mirror, me, said, all my life I wanted to be an insect. But I can't. And I thought, shit, that's an interesting thought. Who's that guy in the mirror? Obviously me. I was standing there wearing a t-shirt. So I sat down and wrote for about 3 hours. I did a brain dump on everything I knew about insects. Huh. And then I spent 5 days crafting and working. I had about 200 pages of notes. I just went ape. And then I did a 3-minute thing. Why I'm saying that is there really are ideas that have you. And if we don't jump on those, then somebody says, okay, sorry, pal, you missed the oomph.
That is a very Elizabeth Gilbert idea. I don't know if you've read Magic Lessons, if you've listened to her podcast.
I have.
Yeah, but she has that idea that the ideas are floating out there in the universe and looking for a receptive vessel to jump into. And if you don't do it, someone else will.
And I think the way that works is when I would write regularly, and I would write regularly, I just go down to the coffee place and I'd sit in and I just write. And I wrote mostly flash fiction, not really poetry, but my stuff is poetic. What I discovered is that if I open myself repeatedly and consistently to the blank page and basically say to my inner world, which is also the world swimming around my head, the eosphere, that I'm here to write and I'm open to whatever. My head felt like a birdhouse, and then the birds come because they felt welcome. And by birds, I mean weird thoughts, stories, ideas. I really think that's True, but you have to open up the store. You have to say, okay, I'm going to spend time writing and let the birds come to my head. And what I discovered was when I do that, then they say, oh, this is a friendly place to come. And now, if I was some, I don't know, left brain business accountant guy who had no time for imagination, the birds might come near my head and they say, well, this guy, the door is closed, you know, and he doesn't have his bird feeder out. So hell, we'll go someplace. Now I have a little neon sign saying, please, ideas floating in the world, come, I'm open. And I really, and my point also is, because I'm long-winded here, Tricia, my point is, in fact, I've lost my point because I just said I was long-winded. There's something about being open enough and trusting that stuff will come. So it's not, yeah, here it is. It's not coming up with ideas.
Yeah.
Out with ideas. I could sit there forever trying to come up with an idea, but I teach workshops in humor and I say, look, don't try to be more funny. Just try to be less serious. don't try. I mean, don't, because the way to kill it, here's the way to kill discipline in writing. A, you got to do it if you want to be something in the writer world. Okay, you got it. And number one, you have to do it. Okay, number two, it's got to be really, really good. It's got to be really, really good. So you've read Shakespeare and you read Proust and you read Steinbeck, you read whatever. And you think, well, shit, I can't do like them. So then you shut down because you think, well, I'm never going to get that good. So then you say, okay, but I got to try. So then you're staring at blank page. And you have the grammar police, the imagination police, the gotta get it right police, the, you know, she's a better writer than I am police. And then you think, well, shit, unless it's beautiful, not, but see, the imagination is the exact opposite.
Yeah.
It says, I don't want to work. I want to play. I want to be, you know, but you may sit there staring at nothing, sipping your coffee and doodling or making random scratches. And then something shows up.
Yeah. So this is part of why I think it's so interesting to talk with you, because it's so different from the answer that I thought that I've been thinking about all day, which by no means is to say it's wrong. That's part of why I enjoy talking to you, John, because I believe everything you're saying. I believe everything that you're saying works for you. And obviously you have a monstrous track record of creativity. So, you know, far be it from me to try to improve upon that.
That's a monstrous record. All right, good.
A monstrous record. Just, you know, your creativity is just like like one of the titans that first came out of and just like, brah! So I feel maybe it's being a different place in my life. But I'm thinking about, it seems like your answer is basically, if it's so much fun that you want to do it, even if life gets very distracting, you're going to find time to do this because it's a thing that you enjoy so much. And I just pose, having been an English teacher for a long time and a caretaker for other people, sometimes I think a lot of folks struggle with the feeling that they don't deserve to take time for themselves, or doing something purely for fun is bad and you should definitely be doing something more productive. And so I'm going to take a different approach here, not contrary, but just adding a little something. So I've had periods in my life where life was very busy, and teaching English to students at a junior high school, or teaching at a high school, and then also being in graduate school. And I didn't have kids, still don't have kids. So fortunately that left me some more free time. But, you know, the only time that I could write was early in the morning before work started, or in the afternoon. And being a teacher, the work never ends. So, you know, I was always saying, okay, I'm going to put the work down, even though I could keep working until midnight. And I'd start writing around, you know, maybe 4:30 or 5, make dinner. I'm a very early riser. So it was like, leave work 4:30 or 5, write till maybe 6, make dinner, sleep, and then wake up at, you know, 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And what I want to say is, you don't really need huge swaths of time to write. the researcher, James Pennebaker, I think is still kind of the preeminent researcher who studied creativity and mental health. And he found that writing as little as 15 minutes a day would have really positive effects on people. And this is something very interesting too. I'm very wary of giving that advice unqualified, because he actually did a little more, had a caveat to that. Because if you're just writing about your feelings and you had a bad day and you're just ruminating it, and it's just like, Jenny's such a bitch, I hate my boss, everything sucks. If you're just doing that kind of writing for 15 minutes a day, it can actually make you feel worse. He gave a few parameters about writing about cause and effect and writing about imagery, which I found fascinating. I'm just like, these are the basic writing tools that you have in a creative writing class, not just writing about your inner feelings, but also writing about concrete reality, writing about cause and effect, seeing how one thing affects the other. So you're seeing how things are transitory and you're not getting stuck in a feeling. You're exploring, like, how does the feeling arise and then how does it dissipate? You know, these are really terrific things. And he basically said, like, do that 15 minutes a day. And people were showing, after doing this for like a month or something, it was showing that people had lower blood pressure. They had a general sense of well-being improved. I think in some cases, like, some people even showed up they wound up having fewer sick days. So this is all really great. And then I've heard that oh my God, I need to look him up. But the guy who wrote The House of Sand and Fog, by Andre Dubus III. Andre Dubus III, who wrote The House of Sand and Fog, was writing in 20-minute increments. And just between work and home, he'd sit in his car and write for 20 minutes longhand. And eventually he had a book and it was option for a movie deal. That's what you want.
If I may jump in, just to, I agree with everything you've said. A couple of thoughts for the listener about mm-hmm. discipline and writing and so on, because I was jotting this down, you know, how I actually do it. It's got to be fun on some level. I've discovered I write... each week I do what is called the Sunday piece, and I sent that out to you. I'm part of a group that's an offshoot of what's called Unity Church, which is a very mm-hmm. progressive, open-ended, you know, many roads, one God, that sort of thing. And I'm given a topic each week, and then I write something, and then I send it out to people. Having the weekly deadline has been enormously helpful for me. But you could make your own deadline. You could mm-hmm. say, well, I've got five friends I want to send a piece of writing to each week, and I'm just going to do a thing. So I'll take the topic. I'll spend hours and hours and hours. It's a one page double spaced or space and a half, whatever, piece. So it's not long. It's like 450 words, but I do it religiously. I've done like 200 of them. Why I say that is it keeps me honest. In other words, having a loving audience and a deadline and having to push myself. In other words, by push myself, I mean, I want to give them something I've never said before. I want to give them something that's concise. I want to give them something that's saying old things in brand new ways. So I'm pushing myself. So number one, get a deadline, get a loving audience, and then strive. In other words, it isn't simply yammering and putting stuff on the page that you always put. See if you can, in some way, stretch it, make it more succinct, make it odder, do something to press yourself. Secondly, is I used to have a thing where I said, I'm going to write a half hour every night. And I would never do that. The thought of doing it was so onerous and, oh God, a half hour, that I would never put my butt in the chair and write. And then I
let me ask, when was this?
This is many years ago. This is maybe 20 years ago again.
Yeah.
Now I put my butt in the chair and I write, but at night mm-hmm. I see a thing and say, and I wouldn't, it was whatever. Then I changed it. Instead of I'm going to write for 30 minutes and then I'd lie there in bed kicking myself for 30 minutes. I wasn't writing. I said, okay, here's the deal, John. I'm going to make a bet with it. I'm going to write every night for 1 minute.
Okay.
Down and see, the whole problem is inertia. It's not writing, it's starting writing.
Yeah.
So I thought, it's harder for me to stop once I got my butt in the chair. You know, I'm here, I'm writing, and now I go for 10 minutes, 20, 30, whatever. What I discovered is my anti-procrastination thing is divide everything into three parts: beginning, doing, and celebrating. So if you're sitting there watching, I don't know, a football, and say, well, I should clean up the living room during commercials, but I don't want to. I want to sit here. Well, let's clean up the room for 15 seconds. Okay. Well, the point is getting started. So if you don't want to write that paper, write for 1 minute.
Yeah.
But if you don't, then the whole thing, see what tires us is the very thing that inspires us, which is our imagination. And you can use it against you. Oh, writing a half hour, that's a pain in the ass. Or no, make it easy. I'll write for 1 minute and then quit.
Yeah.
Or go on. And then at the end, when you've done what you said you're going to do, get up and do a little dance or a high five or kiss your spouse or jump up and down. Do something to tell your brain, hey, dude or dudess, you did that thing.
You know, as you're talking.
Yeah.
I mean, first of all, that's terrific. And my fitness coach tries to convince me to do the same thing with exercise. Like, just try going for 1 minute walk. Just 1 minute. There are times when I really do stop at the 1 minute mark and I give myself a little pat on the back. I'm like, you did it. And she was wrong. Yeah, I do. But sometimes I feel like, well, she's wrong. I did not feel motivated to keep going after that 1 minute. Writing, often I feel a lot more motivated because for me, that is fun. And that is where my happy place is. So I enjoy that a lot more.
Tricia, what makes it fun for you? I think that's an important point for the list.
It's not an easy question exactly, because I feel like, you know, there's periods where the writing, I will do it because it's fun and enjoyable. There's other periods where it starts feeling a little bit onerous. And this is what I want to say, bringing it back to the question about, you know, how do you write when life gets busy? I'm just going to say this. I've been in periods of my life where I only had maybe 15 minutes, maybe an hour to write every day. And I think I enjoyed the writing more, and I think I was more dedicated to it, oddly enough. Not necessarily more prolific, because I was still learning how to write, and I wrote a lot of crap before I hit anything worth sticking with. But I loved it. It was my favorite time of day, and I didn't have enough time to sit around bemoaning my fate and, you know, scratching my butt. I really needed to write during that time because it was the only time I had available. And to some extent that did make it more fun. It made it more meaningful for me. Now that I have more free time and I have a lifestyle where I have a lot more time for writing, I spend a lot more time avoiding it, building up my worry meter, I guess, going, is it good enough? I'll write tomorrow. I don't feel like it today. I'll feel like it tomorrow. I'll have plenty of time to write tomorrow. You know, so there's definitely an advantage to having a lifestyle where you don't have enough time or as much time as you like. And I know a lot of writers who think, boy, I really wish that I was doing this full time, because then it's not necessarily better when you can do it full time. Enjoy the fact that you can barely fit it into your schedule and then fit it in where you can and really enjoy the hell out of it.
And I want to say a couple of things if I may jump in again. When we say it's fun to the listener, I don't know if any of you out there have run in a marathon. I've run in 6 LA marathons. Is it fun? No, it's not fun. On the other hand, is it fun? Yeah, it's way fun. The reason it's fun, and it's a paradox, is this. When I'm running on my own, that's one thing. But when I'm running with 30,000 other people and people are cheering and yelling, they're cheering and yelling, even if you're at the back, but they're cheering and yelling. And when you have that level of cheering, yelling, community, what happens to me is that the inner critic is banished from my head. That little voice says, oh, it's not good enough. I should have done this. I should have gone to a better graduate school. I should have, all of that garbage, I basically say, listen, dude, critical voice, if you're not giving me a hand, you're giving me the finger, and I don't need you right now. So what I found was, it was the weirdest thing. While running a marathon, I was at such great peace because I had not ounce of self-criticism, self-hate. I said, I need every damn speck of energy to da 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 da. And it was fun. And when I finished that thing, I felt like a king. What happened was, and for the next month and a half, every time my critic showed its face and said, well, you know, I said, shut up, jacket. You didn't run that marathon. I did, pal. And guess what? You were no help. So go F yourself out of my head, jackass. My point is, we can make stuff that's hard. In school, they make a split between work and play. That's nonsense.
Yes.
I said, let's take the word work, which means resistance in physics, out. All we're doing is playing. Mm-hmm. But playing isn't just bouncing balls and eating ice cream. Playing is doing algebra. If you do it right, you can play. Second thing is, I've been in many, many writing groups where people only have 10 minutes to write, and they write brilliant, brilliant. Damn. I wrote one of the best. I wrote a piece called In the Ocean of His Mother, that published in the Los Angeles Press. Did it in 10 minutes. It's one of the best things I've ever in my life done. So time isn't the issue. And sometimes compression is, if you only have, the final thing I'm going to say is this, if you just do the 10 minutes and do a crap job. Don't say the best way to kill it is I got to do a perfect job in 10 minutes.
Yes. Yeah.
Crappy. You will not write really well if you are not willing to write really shitty. I mean, you just, because the part of you that writes really well does not need the writing police, you know, making loud noises and telling it where to go. It just needs, let me just do my thing. The other thing is this, if you take 10 minutes in a busy day, and you really feed your soul by writing about something that's just beautiful or amazing, or you recall something from 40 years ago, your whole world will be better. Stuff that pisses you off and annoys you won't. Because guess what? You took 10 minutes to take little you out and play on the swings.
Yeah.
You went to the miracle zone and that whole, stuff doesn't bug me as much. Whereas if I don't do the 10 minutes, if I don't be creative regularly, I will be bothered by all kinds of crud.
I think one of the things that really helped me, because again, this goes back to the idea, I know there are some people who feel when life is very busy, and it's maybe more of an issue that affects women, probably, is my guess. But if you feel like you've got to take care of a bunch of other people's needs and what have you, it's really easy to say, I'll take care of me later. Right now, let me make breakfast for everyone and do all the this and do all the that. And it can be in the home or in the workplace or whatever. I think one of the big things that has shifted for me is saying, I know it seems selfish that I'm going to sit down here and write for myself for 15 minutes, but I know that if I do it, I am going to be a better person for the rest of the day. I'm going to be less cranky. I'm going to be more focused. I'm going to be able to serve other people. It is my obligation to my community that I sit here and do this for 15 minutes so that I snap at people less later on. And I think that's been a really helpful shift for me, going, you're not doing this selfishly. You are doing this to make you a happier, healthier person so you can serve other people more effectively.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that's pretty much it. I think that little mental shift sometimes is what people need. And sometimes, you know, having accountability is a really good way to do this too. If you have someone else who you're showing up for, if you have like a writing partner and you're showing up for them and you know that they're not going to write unless you show up, that's a really great way to stay motivated as well.
Absolutely. Get a writing partner. That's a very good idea. And do writing dates. I adore and love my wife, whose name is Elia Braden. got a website, eliabraden.com, I think.
Also a writer, also poet and poet. She's a multi-talented writer and artist.
Amazing. She's an amazing human being. I'm very lucky to be married to her. Why I bring her up is every time I see her taking time, because she's busy, she's got stuff to do. But when she takes the time to be creative, I just watch her and hug myself because I know that my world is going to be better.
Yeah.
My thing is, I want her to be as creative as she can possibly be. And I want to be creative as I possibly can as well. But when she is doing that being creative thing, I'm just kissing my lucky stars, because I know that her world will be happier and sweeter, and she'll be able to put up with some of my nonsense better. she'll say, I'm thinking this is good news. Everything, I'm going to say, this is what, from what you said, Tricia, makes me think almost everything in our society says, don't stop and take time out to be creative. Everything, you know, so when you sit down, you say, I'm going to take 10 minutes, 5 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever to write. Here are the demons that pop into my head. This is a waste of time. A, B, I'm not making any money. Shit. I got to be next. I'm not famous. This is going to make me famous. You know, I'm just farting around. This is shitty. I'm not getting anything done. I'm not doing anything really practical. Yep. I'm not loading bales of hay. I'm not stacking bricks into a wall. I'm air. I'm dealing with air. So all of that is at the start. And it basically is a way to shut myself down, saying this is selfish and I should be helping others. And I got kids, I don't have kids. I'm going to have stepkids. The point is, The paradox is, a little bit goes a hay of a long way.
Yeah.
If you spend 10 minutes talking to I'll call it your soul. I see writing and creativity as a very, very spiritual thing in the largest sense of that world. And when I've done that, something yummy in me says, John, you got to spend time with you/God.
Yeah.
If you use the God word, I use the God word. And then what happens, like I keep saying, Trump doesn't bother me as much. Life doesn't bother me as much, because got to scratch that little itch. So a few minutes goes a long way. And then what happened? You can say to your kids, hey, kids, you get to play.
Yeah.
Dad wants to play. So here's a sign of their dad is playing right now. You know, he needs his space to do that. I guarantee kids will look at you and know if you are feeding your creative self. And my thing is, if I want to bring out the adult in a kid, I got to bring out the kid in the adult. In other words, me. A lot of teachers are grumpy, angry, and I really think they have kid envy. Why do kids get to have recess? Why do kids get to play? We have to do all the work. I have to correct papers. The kid can just screw around after school. This is not fair. Look, kids can say, why don't you just play more, ma'am or dude or whatever the hey, and then we'll all feel better.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to bring it, this is sort of a subcategory, but I'm curious about your writing practice and the time of day, because I think you said you were trying to get yourself to write 15 minutes or half an hour before bed. Was it specifically before bed?
No, I did that for a while, but I'm a morning person. So that's,
yeah, I was going to ask, what's the difference for you? Do you need to do the writing first thing in the morning, or do you need to?
Here's the cool thing. And incidentally, I love our back and forth here when I like follow some outline. My best writing is this. I'll be lying in bed with my beautiful wife. It'll be like 5 o'clock in the morning, and suddenly a light will go off in my head, because I'm working on my Sunday piece and it's not correct or it's not finished, or I'll wake up and I'll say, oh, cool. Then I'll get up. I'll sneak out of the house. I'll leave a little note, honey, I'm out. I'm going to my favorite writing place, the Coffee Bean here in Oxnard. So I'll get up and everything, I feel like a pirate. I feel like a house thief. I'm sneaking out of it. Don't make any noise. Don't set off the alarm. Don't kick anything. And then I'll get in my car and it's like nobody, it's dark. It's like 5:15 and they open at 5:30. So I'll make it by 5:28. So then I get there and I'm like the only guy, maybe there's one other person. And then I thought, this is my time, because the world hasn't woken up. And I feel now I can play for 3 hours. When I do that, it's just heaven. I mean, it's like, people say to me, John, are you on drugs? Because you're, I'm not on drugs. I just imagine stuff and allow myself to. And yeah, that's the drug. So yes. I don't need drugs. But if I didn't do this, I swear to God, I might need drugs. I'm kidding. Say no to drugs, folks.
I mean, I know that's how my dad got introduced to meditation. Somebody told him, hey, this is like doing drugs except without the negative side effects. And, I think that's really useful. I mean, I think Natalie Goldberg in Writing Down the Bones said something about that. And I'm sure others have as well. Like maybe sometimes people are drinking alcohol because they're not writing and they're trying to numb out the parts of themselves that are creative because they can't face their creativity. And, that's definitely beyond my pay grade. If you've got questions about that, definitely go see a professional. But I think that.
I think Tricia, if I again may jump right in the middle of your sentence there, there is something that Jesus said, I think in the Gospel of Thomas or mm-hmm. something that's kind of obscure. I'll get this wrong, but it's something like this: the talent, and this is Jesus. This is not Benjamin Franklin. This is he said the talents that we use will save us, and the talents that we do not use will kill us.
Yep.
Now I don't know if he used the word kill, but you might as well have.
Yeah.
What I find is that is actually correct. I have a spiritual notion that we are put on this earth, and if you don't work the word God, then skip that part, that we have talents, we have gifts, and if we use these, we will be doing things that we love for purposes greater than ourselves. We will be happy doing that. That's all I need to go further in life. But if we don't do it, it's not neutral. If we don't do it, we will find ways to destroy our world. We'll be lousy spouses. We'll be pissed. And why is that? Because there's something in us that wants to play. It's the little child in us that really does rule us. Mm-hmm. And by child, and see, here's the, we're either childlike or we will become childish. Mm. And the childlike part is the one that got to play, got to write about something in a new way, got to put on a hat and make a funny face, get to play with your spouse, get to make fun of whatever you're doing and play.
Yeah.
And if we don't do that, then we will be childish, meaning rude, selfish, a shitty driver. And we'll be doing it by omission, not being nice, not being gentle, not being, and just being pissy. And that's why I'd say, look, find a way. And it's the least selfish thing you can do.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree with you. And I will say I consider myself a morning person too. And now that I have a little bit more time, I am very cognizant of how the times of day affect my writing process, how a lifestyle change will affect my writing process. So for example, when probably the busiest year I had, I was in graduate school and I was teaching like six classes at a high school, junior high level. And I was taking creative writing classes with Kim Adonizio in the Bay Area. And I had a roommate and a social life as well. And, I would find that I would have to wake up at about 4:45 every morning. I'd go to a coffee shop that played classical music so it wouldn't distract me. They had great quiche. They had great coffee. They weren't too far from my work. And I'd work on my graduate school stuff for a while. And then, unless I had some burning idea that I just had to get out with my creative writing. And when I would write for a little bit first thing in the morning, I kind of felt like, hey, I've done my real work for the day. Now I can relax and focus on the other stuff that needs my attention. And that, that was kind of allowing me to free up and have more energy and attention for the students I was working with, plus also, to be honest, like when you're teaching high school and junior high, like, if you don't do it first thing in the morning, you will not do it the rest of the day because things will happen. The students will come in missing limbs, missing papers, saying, oh, I need this other thing by, tonight or else I will die and the world will end. And so like you will just have so many distractions. If you don't get it in first thing in the morning, you're kind of in real trouble. And sometimes I was able to like knock off around 4:30 or 5 and write a little bit more in the evening. Not always. But now that I'm self-employed again, I find I cannot write first thing in the morning because it's all the other stuff that's cluttering up my head now. You know, it's like if I start writing now, I'm not going to answer the 800 emails I have to answer. And I'm just going to be thinking about all the other things I need to do. And I can't focus on my writing in the morning. So now my routine is that I wake up, I have some meditation, some breakfast, some coffee, and I do the tasks, the little tasks, you know, answering emails, setting up schedules, doing all the like little mishigas that doesn't take a lot of attention. And then around noon, I can go, all that's done. Now let's sit and write. And I got the rest of the day. I don't have to think about anything else, just freedom to do whatever I want. And I don't feel bad about it. And I don't feel like, oh, there's something else I need to be working on right now. So you know,
that's a great point, Tricia. I hadn't thought of that, but that's a very good point because when you were so busy, you knew that you're going to get busy, you're going to get slammed by busyness. So now you got to sneak away and steal an hour or two and write. Yeah. But when you don't have that, those pressures, then it kind of does make sense. Get the gucky stuff done. And then, now you can play. Now you can, whatever works for you. You know, I realize I sometimes do that, get my little monkey stuff done. And then at the afternoon,
I love it too. It's
for the morning though. So
I guess also I look at it a little bit as a reward too. It's like, get this done. And then you don't have to think about it and you can sit down. And how much fun is it going to be to sit down knowing you don't have any other obligations for the day and you just have the rest of the afternoon to yourself.
It's a great thing. I wrote my last Sunday piece. I don't know if you read it. It's called Divine Selfishness.
I haven't read it.
It's about, and by selfish, what we think of is selfish is often not, it's actually self-ish. In other words, we have a new cat. Her name is Phoebe. And, she chews things, eats things, but she has not one bit of shame, remorse, guilt, anything. And she's like, she just does what she does when she wants, how she wants, and tough crap. She's very selfish. In fact, but she has such calm and imperiousness. But I in the piece I said she came from a planet FU because it's like I'm doing what I'm doing. I realized from the cat that when I do what I do and claim it, and it takes conscious claiming, I get to go back when I was a kid, and I remember in fourth grade leaving the cafeteria, going to recess after working in the cafeteria. I ran the dishwashing machine. And I remember going back in my own little funny little world. The walk back on the blacktop was this Aeolian time when I was in my own little zone. Time slowed down. The asphalt expanded. It was like on drugs. I wasn't on drugs. I was nine. When I was singing a little baby talk song to my, and I realized that's the zone.
Yeah.
That is my mojo zone. That's the zone where I'm tapping on the little glass ceiling of myself saying, hey, I'm here, birds, if you want to show up and give me something. That it's just playful. And so it's an oasis. It's the eye of the hurricane. It's the middle of the thing. When we give ourselves time to have that so-called selfish time, we may drop back into a time of childhood when we're wasting time and floating around, but it's not at all a waste. And when you do that, when I do that, then I come back into the world. See the world, how can I say this? The world doesn't care about you. The world is too damn busy with its own shit. When I was a teacher, and I used to say this to teachers, there are two things, teachers, you know, this is kind of scary, but number one, nobody is listening to what you say.
Yeah.
Ever. No one is totally listening, ever, unless what you say is interesting, important, useful, or personal. And then they're listening like 95%, because in order to listen to me, you got to check with stuff outside what I'm saying to see if it makes sense. So you're off someplace, even under the best of circumstances. So talk to people and make it interesting, make it useful, make it personal, or don't talk. Secondly, no one cares about you. So if you care about you, and then you teach like eighth grade when they're teenagers and, you know, screw you, you're a grown up, I don't give a damn, you're my parents, I hate you. You don't need them to love you, like you, anything, because you've already done that. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, hey, I'm immune. You've inoculated yourself.
Yeah, that's very important. Very important.
So then you go up and say, okay, then don't care about me. Guess what? People care. So I'll care about you. I'm not even going to care about me. I'll care about you, Jeff or Suzanne or Margarito. I'm going to care about you. And when kids know that you care, and again, caring could be just really being present for 10 yeah. seconds in a way that's really, really present. Hey, you're really, because most adults are on the move. They got stuff. They got 50 kids. They got junk. And they're not going to be present. They can't. And yet they have to be present. And even yeah. if you've got a load of work to do, you only have one thing to do at any given moment, and then one next thing, and then one next thing. What tires us, like I said earlier, is our imagination. It's I've got a ton of work. You don't, unless you're piling riprap on a river with cement bags. You've got, your work doesn't weigh any, but you will tire you.
Yeah.
So feed you. And then, and the best feeding of all, it seems to me, is finding a creative outlet. Even if you think, oh, I'm not creative. No. If you were a child once, God, you were creative.
Well, and I also want to say this. This is another way where you and I are significantly different, because you talk about the world of childhood and da-da-da-da. And I'm fairly certain there was a time when I had that. I've heard rumors. I've heard times. My parents tell me stories of times when I did amusing childhood things. But my parents have also created this myth that I was born 40. I came out with a scowl on my face and immediately started ordering them around. And that tracks. I could see that being a true story. I think it also has to do with being the older child. I'm the older child. I have a half brother who's 10 years older than me, but that was a big age gap. But then at the age of 2, I had my own little minion I had to train. So, I've been in that position of being the older child, the wise one that needs to teach the other one to, pick up her shoes and bring me things on silver platters. It's a lot of responsibility, and I don't think, if you feel that you also were maybe an old soul, interestingly enough, I think I read this recently that Flannery O'Connor said the same thing. She felt like she was taking things very seriously when she was younger, and she started to let go and be a little bit more free as she got older. I think that's Flannery O'Connor. Don't quote me on that. But yeah, I feel like, you can think your way back to childhood. You can give it a different name too. I don't want to be a kid again. I'm pretty sure I'm happier now as an adult. As a kid, I just remember feeling like I want to do things and the grownups are telling me no. And I hate that. I didn't like it then. I don't like it now. I'd much prefer to be an adult who's got my own driver's license and bank account. And if I feel like just picking up and moving to Costa Rica for 3 years, I can, which is a thing I couldn't do as a kid. So, I'm just advocating that even if you don't feel you had it as a child, you can create it now as an adult.
Yeah, and I can jump in again on that. I don't think the divide necessarily is between adult equals serious and child equals funny or not mm-hmm. serious, whatever. Nothing is probably more serious than a child at play. I mean, when you see a kid on a tricycle going around in circles, they're about as serious as you can get. I'm in the position of having seen you since birth. So I actually yes. knew when you were like 1 foot tall and 2 feet tall.
Was I whimsical? Did I have whimsy?
Here's what I recall, looking back at you. The first word that pops into my head, Tricia, is intrepid. You had a big smile and big blue eyes, and you were intrepidly stamping around, doing stuff, taking charge, knowing that on some level you would have to be the grown up, very early on thing. But you were also, I guess what I'm saying is that it isn't, the serious doesn't mean not childlike, because also you had time for reverie. You're a poet, and that doesn't start when you're 30. It's like you were a poet then, which meant that you saw deeply into things and saw imaginatively into things. And yes, you had responsibilities and you had a younger sister and whatnot. So we all come at this differently. I had a brother who was a year older. Mm-hmm. He was always off by himself with the other kids. I was always left by myself. So my image of me was in the backyard playing with sticks and dirt and toy trucks for like hours and hours and being in my happy place. So naturally, my goal is actually to be a child elder at this point in my life. I want to be a child plus an elder. Getting things done is great. And I've been able to get some things done. I built a career for 35 years, et cetera. I got a nice wife. So I did something. But for me, it's more the joy of linking somehow wonder plus wisdom. I think in the three stages, wonder as a child, wisdom as an elder, and workability as a middle-aged, whatever the heck, somewhere in the future. You want to be able to have all three of those things, the wonder, the workability, and the wisdom. But I didn't know that about you. Yeah, I guess I didn't know you didn't feel you had a childhood. And like you say, have one now.
Yeah. Well, and again, it's not, I had a childhood. I know that there were like times when, I didn't really come out and start dressing myself and all that stuff. And I need to give credit to mom and dad because they kept me alive and fed and clothed and all those things. I don't think they dropped me on my head too many times when I was a baby. It was more of an attitude and wanting to be in charge of things and control things. And so it's funny because for me also my creativity is a lot more about feeling like I want to take all the craziness that's going on in the world and just funnel it into a book, because a book is nice and controllable and you can hold it in your hands and it can be beautiful, it can be romantic, it can be poignant, it can allow for a lot of big feelings in a small space. But part of why I enjoy listening to your work and knowing more about your creative approach is yours is a lot more wild. For me, I'm like, the world is wild enough. I will be the one who will come in and kind of like corral all the cats and make sure they're fed and their food dishes in a row. And I'm going to line things up and bring a little order. Whereas you seem to be a lot more of, let's just tip everything over and see where it lands.
But here's the interesting paradox in that. People have made that point many times to me. I dress, somebody said I dress like an undercover cop. In other words, I am nothing creative. I'm kind of boring in many, many ways. Boring, and I I've learned to be boring on the outside, but I'm not boring. So you can have it both ways. I've worked, as I say, in many, many schools, and you don't want to be too crazy and nuts, otherwise you don't get invited, My thing is, what game do you want to play? I'll dress neatly, whatever the heck I do. But inside I'll have a raging imagination, and I'll let kids know that. I'll let them know that they can play with a foot in this world and a foot in that world. People have said forever to me, I'm two things, weird and intense.
And intensely weird.
Yes, I've looked up weird. It's an ancient Celtic root that means he or she who has found her destiny. Hmm. So when I teach kids, I want them to find their weird, but I also want them to be able to express it in a way that's appropriate. So it's self-expression plus self-control. In other words, heck, I do my fair share of chores and I do my fair share of whatever, and I had to be responsible running my own business for umpteen zillion years. But there's a part of me that can go nuts. And I think that's it. We often think, they're nuts. No, they're part of them is nuts, but they can also pull it back. And that's the wonderful thing. The other thing that you mentioned that strikes me is when you are a writer or a creator, you get to live twice. You get to live lives. One is the life you live, and the other is the life you write about having lived.
Yeah.
And it's a yummy thing to realize, heck, I wrote a piece the other day about being a pirate. I've never been a pirate. I've never wanted to be a pirate. It was called the daintiness of pirates, and about these pirates who came back as grandmothers in a kitchen in Iowa making Thanksgiving dinner. I did a whole thing. You talk about weird. And as far as intense is concerned, I think only intense people get stuff done, but they've got to find a way to make that intensity appropriate.
Yes.
To make it something that works rather than something that's just scary and that sort of thing. The whole thing of creativity is so full of paradoxes that you can.
Yeah, no, it is. I want to make a couple references here. First of all, the whole thing of paradoxes. I wrote my senior thesis at UC Santa Cruz on it was something about creativity and spirituality, but I read Nietzsche's Birth of Tragedy, and he really just talks about the Dionysian and the Apollonian, and Apollo is all about order, light, sun, the lyre, spreadsheets, Google Docs, you know, and Dionysus, it's the wine, it's the Maenads, it's just tear all the heads off and let God sort them out. And you really need the two of them together. And for me, I feel, I'll also reference UC Santa Cruz. I had a wonderful professor, Richard Tiederman, Dick Tiederman. I don't know if he came up with the saying, but he pointed to his head one day and he's like, we use a lot of this, pointing to his head to get to this, pointing to his heart. And I think for some of us, we're like that, you know, we're born kind of, you know, figuring out, knowing what we're thinking all the time and like needing to think our way into our feelings or into our emotion, into our body. And that's, you know, it's not wrong or right. It's just know what your strategy is, and then you can use that to become a more whole person. You can use
And there's a wonderful author and a wonderful book out there that speaks to a lot of that, Tricia. It's called them, and I think I've told you about this, but it's called The Master and His Emissary by Ian McGilchrist, who's just a brilliant guy. It's a thick book. It's a heavy book. It's a, my metaphor is it's like, or my simile is like, it's like a moth trying to eat a redwood tree. I've read it a couple of times. It's a slow go. But his basic point is this. We don't have one brain with two halves. We have two brains. We have a right brain and a left brain. The right brain does what the left brain does. The left brain does what the right brain does, but it's how they do it that's different. Mm. And the right brain is very much what you're talking about feelings and seeing things globally and whatnot. And the left brain is very, you know, what do we need to do? Let's get it working. Let's in a sequence, in an order, more of the Apollonian thing.
Yeah.
It's important. And his contention is that our culture is getting way too far on the left and we need more on the right. We need both, obviously.
Yeah.
But I think doing things on the right, going off the rails, I do a lot with unhinging your mind, because I think poetry is about flights of imagination and depths of emotion.
Yeah.
And if I'm still trying to get it right, be logical in a traditional way, then flights of imagination are off the table and depths of emotion are. And I think that's one of the big things that's wrong with school is staying away from flights of imagination and depths of emotion. Whereas that is where the mojo is.
Yeah.
That is where the juice is.
We can start a whole other podcast on what's wrong with education today. But another book that I really want to plug as well, and it also felt like a moth eating a redwood. It's a book called The Gift by Lewis Hyde. And John, if you haven't read it, I think you would really like this book, but it's, I believe Lewis Hyde is a poet, but the book is a lot more like an anthropological study, all this really interesting anthropological research. But he basically is talking about how when you have a gift, a talent, let's say, it must move forward. I think I might be paraphrasing him, but you know, the gift must move forward. And if you're not going to use it, it is going to destroy you. And it's really not yours to keep. And he really, one thing I just found so fascinating, he talks about how in Native American culture, and I realize there's more than one tribe and what have you, and I can't remember off the top of my head who he was talking about specifically, but basically you had a gift economy and you didn't have a concept of private property. So when somebody needed something, you basically lent it to them with the understanding they were going to return it. And if you were lending them something like, let's say, seeds for their crop, it was understood that you were going to grow some of your own crop, then you were going to give them what you had grown plus some more if you could. And so when the Europeans came and the Native Americans gave them stuff, the Europeans interpreted it as, oh, this is now mine. Whereas the Native Americans were like, yeah, you can borrow this. And then later they expected to get it back. And that's where we get that phrase Indian giver, like giving someone something and then asking for it back. But for Native Americans, it's like, it wasn't mine to begin with. We were always just loaning it to you. We were always expecting it back. How can you give something that doesn't even belong to you? You know, so I feel like that's kind of the way it is with art. If you are given some kind of talent, some kind of ability, it's your duty to bring it forth. I think I'm talking myself into actually doing some writing later today instead of giving up on my entire career.
I think it's a good thing for you to do. I'm glad. Can I jump in on that?
Yeah, go ahead.
You said a lot of really important things there, Tricia. If I were to have, in fact, this is going to be my motto for my year this year, 2023, is I believe in myself. Mm-hmm. And I would recommend that to everyone, to believe in yourself. What that means is you, number one, really have to take care of yourself. Mm-hmm. I like this, and I think we're all creative. We're all creative in our own ways. We're all creative differently. Poetry is one form, writing is one form, drawing is another, painting, dancing, and doing anything, I think, can be done creatively, mindfully and creatively and whatnot. I like to think of that part of me that is creative as a living entity. I love child, and when I used to go and write for hours, I think of me taking my little boy out to the park, you know, Lincoln Park in Alameda, and pushing him on the swing. So we got to play on the swing. And so I do that for a couple of hours. And then the world didn't bother me so much. I didn't need the world to be good to me. I didn't need people to be other than what they were. They can be whoever they want. Whatever. It was a happier world. If I think of it as a growing entity, then it wants to grow and it wants to play, and it grows by playing. It does not grow by doing push-ups and work. It plays. Now, that playing could involve doing push-ups and work, but underneath it all, it wants to strive. It wants to perfect itself. And I think, you know, learn from everyone, but compare yourself to no one.
Yeah.
Yes, you're not going to write like whoever, you know, pick someone out there. You're going to write you. But that creature in me, if you don't allow it to play and grow, it will become angry and it will become sullen. It just will.
Yeah.
It doesn't want to compete with the world. It doesn't want to have to be famous or earn a lot of money. It just wants to play and grow. And in so doing, give everyone else permission to play and grow. When I would do my talks, they were creative and fun. And the basic thing I was telling teachers is you have permission to be creative. And then there's the possibility of creative. And then there's the persistence in being creative. And then there's the promise of creativity. And when people feel that promise, everything gets better. And they're not hoping the world gets better, because who knows what the world's going to do. All you can do is your world. And I think for our podcast today, we started with the notion of, you know, how do you carve out time?
Yeah.
You don't if you don't want to, but you do if you think of it as taking care of you and that little
thing,
you know.
Well, and here's what I want to say too, a little addendum on that, because, and it's, it's not either or, it's both. When I get to a point where I feel like, oh, what I'm working on is so important and only I can do it, and it is necessary, you can get a little anal retentive about that. You can get a little clenched. It can make writing less of a joy. So I think the paradox is actually to be able to have two thoughts at the same time. And one is like, this is super important. It is not a waste of time. It's not a waste of my time. It's not a waste of other people's time. It is important that I do this for my own mental health, for my own emotional well-being. You can really just say like, if I do this, I'm going to be less, I'm going to have lower blood pressure, and I'm going to have to spend less money on my doctor's bills in the future. That on its own should be reason enough to sit down and write for 15 minutes a day. But you also have to say, also, doesn't matter, not that important, not super serious. What I create may be terrible writing today. So it's both this valuing, setting the process as this priority for yourself, knowing that it is important enough for you to set aside, even if it is just 15 minutes, and at the same time, relaxing and not worrying about what happens in that 15 minutes, you know, as long as you're there.
Right. And also there's another paradox in that, I'll write my Sunday piece and that isn't always easy. You know, that's like sometimes wrestling with an anaconda. I can't say how I'm going to say it. I'll spend a long time trying to figure out. I'll make many, many false starts. Then ding, something will be a little, a piece of something, a beginning, and I'll follow it. What I find interesting is I used to not like to edit my work. I thought, I like to get it out. I like to play, get it out.
Yeah.
But I don't have to go over it. And what I realize now is I've got a different feel about that. The editing itself now is play. So what I do is, and I don't even use the word edit. Mm-hmm. I think more of in terms of polishing.
Yeah.
It's like polishing stone. And I realized as a kid, I did many perseverative activities. I was, like I said, alone a lot. And I'd go in the backyard and invent stuff. I did the javelin throw. I didn't have an actual javelin, but I got a big long piece of bamboo and I polished it. And I threw the thing 5 million times. I did the shot put 5 million times. There was an iron ball out near the barn. My point is, I'll do the Sunday piece and I will read it over and over and over and over 18 million times. Mm. And that isn't work. That's as fun, because the part of you that wants to play is the one that says, I want to nail this.
Yes.
I want to nail this thing. And I want to nail it the only way that only I can do. In that sense, it's very important, but it's not false importance. It's not saying, oh, I'm better than anyone. So if you're going for better than, you're BSing yourself. If you're going for, I really want to say this, just in it, and the penny has to drop. I'll get editing suggestions from other people. And if they don't work, I'll say, nah, you're trying to make me do a better horse, but I'm actually doing a donkey. I'm actually doing a donkey. I don't want a horse. I'm doing a donkey with a broken foot. So, but the penny's got to go. But my point is that too is the fun of it, the working over and over and over. Also, here's the thing to keep me honest.
Yeah.
5 years ago, I had these, you can see that, you can't see this, but I'm holding it up to, this is an audio tape. I have a little, what is it, a 5x7? Is that a card?
Mm-hmm.
No, 3x4, whatever the hell. It's an index card. It's what? And every day, this is starting over 5 years ago, I make two columns. One says A, the other side's S. A stands for art. I'm going to do something artistic. And the S stands for study. I'm going to do something involving developing my brain, my heart and soul, whatever. I keep track of how many minutes, hours a day I do creative and how many minutes, hours I do study per day.
Yeah.
And I've done it now for five. And my goal is to do 3 hours a day of creative and then 1 hour a day of study. I think I've stayed pretty close to that. I know that may sound like bragging, but yeah. I do track it. And the tracking is a way to keep me honest, to say, okay, and maybe I'll not write at all one day, but the next day I'll write more. And it at least keeps me on at the end of the year. I haven't looked at these things, but I could. That's a little fun device as well. And then I also meditate every day. And I thought I couldn't do that. I meditate for an hour a day. And I started that. I think an hour, God, that's stupid. It's like staring at a blank wall. Because I was at that Kyle Cease conference. He said, you get up early and meditate an hour. I thought, I can't do that crap. And every time I do it, I think I can't do it. And every time I finish, I think, my God, I did do it.
Yeah.
Every time I want to stop the meditation, or I think, how much longer is it? A little voice in my head says, it's never going to stop. And then I get quiet. If I say, I've got only 10 minutes, 10 minutes now feels like an hour. If I say, hey, dude, it's never stopping. Mm-hmm. Shit. Okay. Then quit asking. The childish part in you will want an ice cream cone and want to stop.
Yeah.
But the childlike part is willing to do stuff because it really wants to say something that it as a kid, and now you as an adult can say, if you're a child plus adult.
Well, and here's something else I want to say, kind of a little piggybacking on that. You know, you've been saying, believe in yourself. I'm not going to totally, I mean, if that works for you, go for it. So yeah. One of the things that I've actually found is like, no, I don't have to believe in myself. That's a lot of pressure, you know, to believe in yourself. I feel better for me when I say like, I believe in the writing itself. I believe in the power of poetry, or, you know, sometimes I just surrender to nature and I'm just like, what do I need to do today? The trees are making all the oxygen for me. The plants are making all the food for me. I can just sit. I can coast, you know? And I feel that way with writing.
I've never thought of that. That's a really, really great
point. Oh my God. You know, living in Costa Rica for 3 years, you really do gain some perspective. It's like, first of all, it's too hot to work. And second of all, this is true. I mean, I knew several people who survived by just sleeping on the sand every day. And then they would wake up and they'd climb a coconut tree and they'd pick some coconut and then they would sell it to the tourists and get enough money for their food, not enough money for shelter, just food. And then they would sleep under the turned over canoes that the fishermen used. And there would people go out fishing every day, and then they would sell fish hanging from a stick by the side of the road. And that was fine. And I should also just say, like, you know, Costa Rica is a pretty well-developed country. There are also doctors and people who make medical equipment and stuff like that. But you could conceivably support yourself and stay alive just by, you know, going out and catching fish or picking coconuts. And that's really given me a different perspective on living, going, yeah, it's happening through me. I'm here as part of it. There's a great quote, and I forget who said it, but it's something like, I read the dictionary. I thought it was just a long poem about the world. And for me, a lot of the time when I feel very, I get that voice in my head that's like, oh, you are a serious writer and you must do serious things. It's so important. Only you can prevent forest fires with your writing. Only you can write the next great you know, that kind of voice. I feel like, no. Just look out the window, record what's going on. What's going on out the window, that's the greatest story ever told. That's the great American novel right now. I'm just a scribe sitting here writing it down. And if I feel like this pressure to be super smart or whatever, it's like, I got to kick that voice out and just let things channel. And that puts me in a much more relaxed state of mind.
That's a very good point. And I hadn't thought about that, but the more you say it, it really does make sense. If I say believe in myself or believe in yourself, there is a lot of pressure in that. Or there can be. I mean, believing yourself also means take care of yourself and don't kill yourself.
Yes.
But the phrase is, believe in yourself, you know, then I gotta be a champion, I gotta be a hero. And that's that's nothing but pressure. But what you make me think of, So thank you for that, because that really gives me a, wow, gee, I hadn't thought, that's amazing.
Yeah.
But the word that I jotted down 3 times in a row was trust. Trust.
Yes,
Trust the world, trust you, trust. You know, we're not just story or poet writers or readers, we're also poet story seers. Things are epiphanal. We see in epiphanies. Most people kind of don't. Most people don't even see stuff. They just recognize stuff. To see something, to really see it, my rule of thumb is it sort of looks odd.
Yeah.
If you've been married 20 years and you really look at your wife's left ear to the point of and odd doesn't mean bad. It means
no.
May I read a quick poem that I wrote the other day?
Yeah, in fact, you're welcome to do that, but I was just going to say we're at the hour and a half mark, and I wondered if you'd like to close us out with either your Sunday piece or if you had something else in mind.
I'd like to close us out with the poem that speaks to what you just said, and it just got published in the Los Angeles Press. I don't know if you've heard this one I did. It's called In the Ocean of His Mother.
I don't think I've heard that one at all.
Oh, okay. Anyway, it's short. And the reason I want to close with this is it's what you were just saying. Mm-hmm. I carry a notebook. I'm always taking notes. I just was sitting at the Coffee Bean, my favorite writing place, and just noticed that this is back in August. And I noticed this little thing, this ordinary little scene. And I wrote this quickly, just like in vump, without really trying. It's called In the Ocean of His Mother. I saw a little boy today at the Coffee Bean rolling on the floor, his mother, a giant building beside him. He was reaching for something, maybe the same thing I'm reaching for, something in thin air. He was giggling and blonde and 2 years old, squirming on the ground. Are you going to just let him do that, Mom? I mean, people walk on that floor. She reaches down, a young, attractive woman in bib overalls, exposing a blue and yellow and pink butterfly on her ankle. In one fell swoop, he's hugging his mother's shoulder, bent over, lost in the ocean of his mother. It seemed to me his world blurring before his eyes. I wish I could catch his eyes. They're swimming, mindless and uncomprehending, the way I always want to be. Or comprehending the way spiders do. He's swimming now in his mother, the height and the heft of her, the pure safety of her. Nothing will be so safe ever again. I want to tell him. I want him to dream backwards into this memory now so present, make it ever present for him. I can do nothing but watch. I miss my mother, who is in heaven, if there is such a place, which I know there isn't. I wish her there anyway, in peace, feeling the ocean she once was for me, lifting me up those many times as I stared dumbly and happily, held aloft by a tree that rustled and swayed and had a beating heart. Where is my mother's beating heart today? My mother gone now 30 years. Motherhood, thank God, is everywhere. She's here holding a small, heavy boy full of not knowing. He swims in her and floats on her like a yellow basking face-up fish in the green sun. Who knows? Perhaps in this moment the sun is green. Perhaps the sun is wearing tan overalls. Perhaps the sun has a butterfly tattoo on its left ankle. The 30-year-old sun, the 30-year-old mother, perhaps my mother.
Do you want to do a random act of kindness? How about a senseless act of beauty? Please rate and review us and write a comment on this episode.
It helps us get heard, get seen, and it helps other poets find us in the chaotic distractions of cyberspace.
Are you a poet who wants to be interviewed on the Poetry Salon cast? Contact Trisha at thepoetrysalon.com and send some of your work to be considered.
And don't forget that this writer will be teaching a guest workshop on the last Sunday of this month at 2 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. To purchase tickets, write to Trisha at thepoetrysalon.com.
Thanks again for being part of our community. And whoever writes the worst draft wins!
Yay!